Welcome to Office Hours with Adam Peterson, where I talk to business owners, employees, entrepreneurs and experts to find answers to those day-to-day questions about life and work in Luxembourg. If you have questions you'd like answered, let me know at adam.peterson@rtl.lu or on LinkedIn. But for now, on to today's show. Ending illegal discrimination, restoring merit-based opportunity. On the surface, it sounds like a continuation of the move to a more liberal society, but it is in fact Executive Order 14173, signed by President Trump on the first day of his second term. It was accompanied by the more aggressive-sounding Order 14151, ending radical and wasteful government DEI programs and preferencing. So welcome to Office Hours. The pushback against the DEI agenda has been turbocharged into a full-blown backlash. But what does this mean for companies and what does it mean for employees? To help me answer this question and more, I have Zuza Reda-Yakima, the founder and managing partner of Pink Not Red, a boutique PR and brand management agency, and Dr. Myrna Leitman from the Luxembourg School of Business. So let's get into it. Do we still need DEI policies? Zuza, you've got a background in journalism and finance, two traditionally male environments. Do you think we've solved the gender equality issue yet?
Oh, no, we are far from it. And I don't think that it's just about me thinking so. I think that we have a lot of data showing that we are quite far from reaching any gender equality in the workplace.
So give me a couple of personal examples about things that have happened to you or in your career.
In my career, well, maybe I should focus on since I'm in Luxembourg, because I've lived quite around the world. I'm originally from Poland, but I also worked and lived in Mexico for several years and in Ireland. And to be very honest, unfortunately, in Luxembourg is where I have encountered the most gender profiling or gender.
So it's the most patriarchal of those societies, would you say?
Yeah. So my very first example was, I think, like in the second week that we had moved here, we went to a bank. My husband already had a bank account for professional reasons, so he was just giving me, a POA, a power of attorney to the account. I was standing there with him, the clerk, a young guy. Honestly, I think it was in his, maybe early 30s, and not even asking me for my occupation, he put housewife. I was standing there. Yeah, I was like, okay, great. And then when I asked him, I said, oh yeah, because most of the women who come to Luxembourg, they don't work, so I assumed so. It was kind of, I hope that it was a one-off.
But it's not seen that way.
These sorts of things have
carried on. And that flows through then into, is it a myth? Gender pay stats were released last year and Luxembourg does not have a gender pay gap. Do we think that's true?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is true. I'm sure that, if government uses us as its PR campaign, then I'm sure that it is true. The only problem is that it depends also where women or what positions women have. And unfortunately, a very recent study or statistics from the Eurostat, the European Commission statistics body, shows that Luxembourg has the lowest share of women in top positions. So yes. That's kind of...
So let me bring in Dr. Myrna Leitman. You teach a course, Women in Leadership.
That's correct.
So you know a lot of the academic background and research on this. Help me understand these figures around the gender pay gap.
When you look at Luxembourg, the truth is that there's no gap, but only superficially looked at the data. But when you go deeper and try to understand the statistics behind it, the research shows that basically women are almost equally paid as men hourly. But then when we look where they sit on and whether they sit on the boards, do they do part-time jobs or do they do full-time jobs? And on a yearly level, how much they earn, there's truly a gap in between how much women earn and where they're positioned and compared to men. If we look at Luxembourg, I believe, and the research also confirms it, it's because of the industry. In a male-dominated industry such as financial sectors, and there's still this glass ceiling that we know of where women are, it's for them impossible to reach that positions.
So let's take it step by step then. So Luxembourg, obviously heavy steel industry in the 1970s, moved to finance, also male-dominated. And one thing I was looking at the data myself around the pensions. So the Chamber of Employees said that The female pensions are 36% lower in Luxembourg than male pensions. Only Netherlands and Malta are less equal. I'm hearing that because of our industries, maybe, we're actually not where we would like to be, despite that hourly comparison.
I would say the industry is one thing, but also if you look at the expectations for women in actually dual careers, so having children and keeping the children on the levels we are expecting the children to go. Even if we look at the data when it comes to the career aspirations, and there's a research behind it, says that if compared early stage, women wanna have careers, but in a male-dominated country where we're leaning towards men, there's no support system, there are no role models, there are no policies. And when you combine all of that, it's a synergy against the woman that wants to and is trying to aspire and have the career next to the family, next to the social life, and keeping, you know, everything in line.
You said there was a glass ceiling. Is there a way that that's measured? Is it like boards? Is it CEOs? What's the data they use?
There are different, I would say, metrics behind this, but it's also about perception. One thing is to look into what is the percentage of women on boards. And then another thing is to actually ask women and men in one company or many companies, what do you think there is or isn't a gap in between the women, and can women aspire?
Looking at those statistics that I mentioned before, so it's important also to say that Luxembourg has only 22% of women holding executive positions.
So 22% of executive positions have women holding them.
Yeah. Now, the top performers is Sweden, who's okay. I mean, like, we know that the Scandinavian countries are much more advanced in terms of gender equality. But in the second place, it's Latvia, and then Poland and Bulgaria. So what I want to say is that it's more of a mindset. Maybe also, you know, some historical reasons. I can say that for a fact that in Poland, because of communism, actually it helped in a sense, because everyone had the same job, so everyone was working or not working. But at the same time, you know, it's a little bit disappointing for Luxembourg when we are so short on talent, and everyone keeps on saying that there's not enough skilled people, and less people feel attracted to move to Luxembourg. This message is surely not something that would encourage, you know, woman to move, right?
Yeah, I'm quite surprised. I think of Luxembourg as being very progressive, and I wouldn't naturally put Poland and Bulgaria at the top of the most progressive league table. So that's quite a surprise to me. Mm.
So when we look at the research, there's support behind this. For sure, if you have a push from the government, such as we had 20, 30 years ago with Scandinavian countries, it can help companies to actually promote women, and then we see long-term benefits. But there's certainly as well influence from kind of a country. Was it socialistic or capitalistic, and whether then this is supported by the government that is on hand to kind of grow on the influence, not just women. I think we should talk about minorities as well. Yeah. Right, if you have a great mindset and it's supported by policies, then the company or the country can flourish. But if there's something missed from the equation, so you have maybe male-dominated industry within the country, then you do not have policies for inclusion. You have diversity on paper, but no policies there. And then you have separate segregations of nationalities living in certain parts of Luxembourg, not socializing. Yeah. Then within this equation, what you have is polarization, right? And you don't have as influential either minorities or women within the companies.
I also wanted to add to what Mirna mentioned about women taking, obviously, like everywhere around the world, a career break when they have children. My two colleagues have small kids, and when they were telling me how difficult it was when the kids were little, you know, with the school system, with the whole idea that you have to pick them up at 2 p.m. and then how much it costs for the kid. I honestly am not an expert in this topic, but I just couldn't understand how we want to encourage women to go back to work faster, even if they wanted to. It's almost impossible, because then it costs them more than they are earning.
You know? And I'd like to add the COVID, homeschooling, and the situation of, you know, having kids at home, both of the parents at home, and trying to kind of balance in between all of the expectation was not helping women progress in the career. Many of them actually felt overwhelmed. And one of the papers that I issued, and it was actually published 2023, was going into focus groups of women and men and how they experienced the COVID and then working. And many of the women were actually overwhelmed with this dual career. Men not as much. The problems, they said, it was technology. I did not know how to reach my colleagues. With women, it was like, I had no idea from the countertop in my kitchen. What do I do first? Do I school my kids or do I go for a meeting?
And not all families are the same. So it's worth saying.
Agree.
So it's not
yes.
offense, but in general, on the average, you're saying that. So you've hit so many points there, and I want to circle back to a couple of them. One of them, I was really surprised by you saying that it's the shadow of communism is still persists.
It's more in the mindset. Well, it's even, okay, I'm not an expert. I'm not a sociologist or a historian, so please take it with a pinch of salt. But from the discussions that I've been having or hearing in Poland is that first there were all the wars that we went through where, you know, the men were not there. Women had to work. I mean, like, they were the supporters of the family, and many men would not come back from the war. Then there was communism where, everyone would work. I mean, we actually had, because there were not enough hands, with the ruined economy, there was actually a very famous poster called Women Drive Tractors, kind of encouraging women to drive. Like, there's no job that you cannot do, women. You can also drive tractors. Mm. I don't want to say, you know, Poland is a poster child for, you know, gender equality and stuff like that. There's also a lot of, you know, it's also about political views. We know that until recently there has been also a strong conservative government. But it is, honestly, also about just picking up. And, you know, Polish are kind of, I've heard this phrase personally, I can tell you this story, I heard it when I was working here in a corporate environment at some point, that I'm too Dutch in how I express myself, too direct. It was funny because Polish are, I didn't know that Dutch are like this, but Polish definitely speak their mind.
I used to work for a Dutchman and they are too direct. But they also use it as in my opinion, this is generalization, there's also a tendency to use it as an excuse.
Yeah.
I'm allowed to be direct because I'm...
But this helps because, you know, I've never felt that I would not say something in Poland because I'm a woman and someone would say, you are too bossy or too pushy or too direct or stuff like that. While, and now, another, if you'd like me to, another of those personal stories, so at the company that I was working in Luxembourg many years ago, promoted to lead a team, and there was this coaching program, like, for any new manager. They had like those, you know, several one-on-one sessions with a coach, external coach that was hired to do, you know, like, for the transition. And at some point, she was a woman, and she said, you know, for the other managers who have been here in this company for many years, I was then in my mid-30s, it's quite unusual, and you know, that you are a young woman and you are at the same level as they are, so maybe you should just try to kind of like make it easier for them. I honestly, this was the advice that I heard from a woman to a woman, saying that I should maybe, you know, go and suggest that we go for coffee so they get to know me and then they understand that I'm nice. And why would I have to, like, would a man hear it that he's should make it easier for, you know, people to accept him?
I love that story. I love that story. And I'm like, my first impression in that situation would be also as yours, like, truly, whether a man would ever get that kind of advice, right? But then again, maybe she was coming from this side of understanding the company culture. And this is what I want to make as a point, right? Maybe some 10 years ago, for sure 20, 30 years ago, the companies were actually differently behaving. Autocratic leader as an archetype of a leader was the leader leading those kind of culture, company values, and also behaviors. But the world has shifted and changed. It's not anymore about monopoly. It's not anymore about, you know, being first. Not only about that, it's about collaboration and teamwork, and thus the diversity and having people diverse is at stake here.
I was looking at some data. PwC said for the OECD, it would take 46 years to close the gender pay gap. It's like, this moves at a glacial pace. How can we get this to go quicker?
That's a 1 million, billion, gazillion question, I think,
but
you're
didn't you think
asking.
But I think the whole idea of pay transparency would help.
Because, as a first.
Then you know what you are asking for, and they cannot tell you that, that you're asking for too much.
But are there ways around it in the company? So, and this maybe come back to the levels. So Joanne Ferris was on my show in series one, and she was describing a situation where she went on maternity leave, came back, effectively had the same pay, had the same job title, but was reporting to someone two layers below her. The letter of the law had been followed in terms of not being discriminated at job title, salary. The reality within the culture in the company was that she had been discriminated against. Mm.
And now we go into another set of problems. The thing we should discuss as well is the self-esteem of an average woman. Transparency about the salary is like, I know what I'm supposed to ask. But how do I dare? How do I start? That really is then another question there.
So it's an interesting point that you raised, Mona. I did a course, I Am Remarkable, is something Google did to try and get women to self-advocate. And I saw a criticism of it that said, just a second, why are we asking people to self-advocate and be like men? Can't we create an environment that lets the women succeed at being a women?
You're pushing the right buttons, I would say, from research side, because one of the things we look into is if we make women act more like men, will they have even more prejudice from women and men? Because it's not expected from women to behave like men. It's more expected from them what is needed today for the leadership position, which is emotional intelligence, empathy, and everything. But the question stands, why do we expect women to behave like men? Because the system is like this in the world, in the companies, where still it's governed for some with a presence and with this, like, give me 120%. And interestingly enough, we have like books written on confidence and competence, and there is research showing that there's a negative correlation. The more confident people are, the less competent they are. And yet, with the confident people, we see them smart. We see them as, I want to be like them. I want to be led by that person. That person seems as if they know everything. But then again, the correlation shows the more confident, less competence.
Oh, the Dunning-Kruger effect or something.
There is with learning. There is even the research and the book on this. Like, why do so many incompetent men lead? It's interesting. It's written by a man, not a woman.
So on that moment, let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and then we'll ask, what are we going to do about it? Diversity, allyship, equality, on the list of 147 words, if I counted correctly, that Trump has demanded the US federal government avoid or limit. But also on this word are female and disability. Welcome back to Office Hours. In part one, we looked at whether there is still a need for DEI policies. And in part two, we're about to get into what we should do about it, but I'm going to do a quick fire. So Myrna, just to push home the issue that we still have a problem, give me a fact that shows that we don't yet have an equal society.
I know we're talking about Luxembourg and Europe, but if we look at the Fortune 500 companies and we look into the CEO position, only 8% of those positions are held by female.
Wow. And Zuza, a quick personal anecdote.
Well, we were buying a flat in Luxembourg 2 years ago, and, you know, we got the Notary Act. We were buying it 50-50. And in the Notary Act, it appears that the buyers are Alexander Yakima and his wife, Susanna. Nobody asked me if I want, even thought about asking how come? I'm like,
50% of the money and you don't get 50% of the credit. Not good. So I think we've decided we still need to do something about it. I want to start with a question I've had. Quotas, good or bad, where do you stand?
Good.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I would love a world where we don't need quotas. Mm. But the reality now is that we do need them. And, you know, if it was easy for men for centuries, they were privileged, then okay, let's make it a little bit easy for women now.
20 to 30 years ago, once again, Scandinavian countries had quotas. Look at them now when it comes to index of innovation, index of happiness, and other indexes that we look next to the how much did they earn.
So I've heard both sides. My own reaction is, professor of management practice, you want to do something, you put in some targets, you do some actions to meet those targets. So for me, it's very mechanical to do that. Having had conversations with women at some events, they have said they're against quotas. Mm. And my understanding is they felt that they wanted to know they got the job out of their own merit and did not want the imposter syndrome to be amplified by the existence of quotas. So can you recognize that from your courses, Mirna?
I can recognize this, and there are for sure a percentage of women actually claiming this, and I understand their side, but it's been like that for decades, and it did not help with imposter syndrome, because imposter syndrome isn't something that somebody tells me. It's how I perceive whatever is being told to me. So it's subjective, no matter of a support or not. So there are women who have mentors, they have a support, and they're still like, I cannot do this. And if they had like even a negative situation without quotas as we have it at the moment, that imposter syndrome is not being helped at.
Yeah. And imposter syndrome is not limited to women, by the way.
I agree. I'm sorry. Yes.
No, that's fine. I just wanted to say that. Susan.
Yeah, I mean, from my field, so communication and brand management, you know, typically there's more women working as PR executives or PR experts. But if someone told me, and it's true that also in my team, we are four women and one man. But if someone told me, okay, there's a quota and I have to hire a guy, I would be like, okay, maybe it would take me a little bit longer because the pool is smaller, because less guys study creative communication than women. But yeah, I'm like, I would be open to it because, well, I want to have a diverse team. So sure. Yeah.
But here we're talking about quotas for the leadership positions, right? The quotas that affect big companies, and the research shows having quotas on the decision-making positions makes impact on the performance.
So give me some stats on that, Mirna, because I think you did a post on that.
I did. So basically, if we look into what are the positives, if you have a representation of women on the boards, it affects the innovation, it affects the lowering costs, and it affects the profitability of the company. How come? Only because the diversified boards, and I'm talking not only women but in minorities, can better understand the surrounding, can better understand the customers and their needs. But it's not only on the macro level that we are looking into the differences. If we look at the differences on the team level, and if we look at the differences on the productivity level of the person, it shows as a difference once you have a diversified team.
So I want to pull up on one point there. Why doesn't the market fix this? If diverse boards make better decisions, why do the companies who do not have diverse boards go out of business and the ones that do have diverse boards stay in business?
I mean, like, I don't think that we want to say that if it's only men or only women that the company will go out of business. We are just saying that it improves and the company is even better when there is diversity. And if I may add, my only comment to quotas is that, of course, it has to also be adapted to an industry, or at least be progressive in the sense that if you have an IT center and you have 100% or 95% guys, of course you cannot from one day to the next say that now it has to be 50% women, right? I mean, because at university you don't have enough students probably of those faculties.
I want to add also that companies in the past were actually competing in how speedy they can do something. They could do something speedy if they had technology. Technology nowadays is everywhere. It's not as expensive as before. And now you need people, and you need people with different competencies to glue as a team. It's hard to have a team of great people unless you understand what are problems and struggles with well-being, with emotional intelligence, stress, and everything that we see from research. And women are just better prone to this, that we have a better radar for emotional intelligence than men. For men on those positions, yeah, you can smile, on those positions, for men, it's more about target achieving. And today's world is not only about targets. It's about targets with people, not burning people on the way.
And why I also wanted to vote for quota or some kind of imposed regulation around it is in Luxembourg, it's quite, well, several years ago, there was an initiative launched called No Woman, No Panel. So kind of, you know, in the public discussion that there are women. And, you know, it looked great. Companies were signing it. And then I remember I attended one event where there was, again, zero women on the panel. And then, you know, the explanation was like, oh, yeah, we would like to have, but there was nobody interesting woman. Yeah. And so kind of like either you do it, you sign it and you do it. So if it's not imposed, unfortunately, it's not working because there's...
I've seen some research that says if you have a panel where there needs to be one woman, then it makes no difference to decisions. If you have a panel where there's at least two, then it starts to make a difference because otherwise people go, huh, it's the token woman. So then it's self-defeating. And that was some work done by the Behavioral Insights team. A really good website, lots of really good toolkit about how to improve gender equality that I recommend people look to. I'll put some links in the show notes. We've had a lot in there, and I've got two very passionate women telling me, and I agree with you, that this needs to be fixed. My worry is that it's going to take us too long. Honestly, I think if you care about this topic, I think we need to stop debating amongst ourselves about whether you need quotas or not. Let's just make the decision and get on with it. I also think that we need to start with legislation. I was impressed at an event recently that Rosa Luxemburg were looking at 37 demands for legislation for the government. I do think a better strategy would be to focus on two or three. So let's get focused, let's get coordinated, let's be pragmatic, and then maybe we can start to see a difference, and let's get out of our echo chambers. Otherwise, unfortunately, I'm worried that my child will be having this conversation when he's in my position in 20, 30 years' time.
And let's call it out when it's happening.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I want to thank you. This has been a lot to fit in this episode. So thank you very much for your time. So if you agree, disagree, comment on LinkedIn, send me an email. And if people want to get in contact with you, Zuza, how would they do that?
I think LinkedIn is the perfect tool.
LinkedIn for me as well. Thanks.
Thank you both very much. And thank you to the listeners.